Thank you. I'm gonna stay seated. I just don't really feel like standing right now. Plus, it kind of just feels natural with this group. So since we have read Philemon in its entirety, we can together engage in the following thought experiment. Let's say that this is the only document we have from the first generation of Christians. Let's ask, what if this is the only piece of history from the Jesus movement in the first century that has been preserved? What then would we know about this movement? What would our understanding of Christianity be like? First, we should note that this is a letter. Often we forget that many of these biblical books aren't books at all. They're someone else's mail. This is not, with caps, the book of Philemon. Nor do I like the word epistle, as if Paul meant to write an official and scholarly theological treatise in the form of a letter. In fact, Paul had no idea he was writing a part of the Bible when he wrote this letter. The fact that it is a letter means it was an address in response to a particular situation with a particular purpose in mind. It also means we don't have the whole story. We're only seeing one piece of it. But let's try to be historians and see if we can construct a somewhat definite understanding of this letter and the community of Christ followers it concerns. The author of the letter is named Paul, and evidently he has been imprisoned for his activities as a Christ follower. And he is not alone. He is imprisoned alongside other Christ followers. So apparently imprisonment can be a consequence of following Christ. Christians may consist of people who are, in the eyes of the law, criminals. We also learn that slaves can be Christians, and also masters can be Christians as well. So social hierarchies and differences in socioeconomic status do not seem to matter in this community. Why? Because they are all, and the Greek word is synergos, that is, co-workers, partners, comrades. Paul calls them all saints and beloved siblings, which means that first century Christ followers, over against whatever rank and status they held in their respective localities, reckoned each other equals. They understood themselves as being in common with each other so that they looked out for each other and took responsibility for one another. In other words, the Christian community was a community of love, or at least apparently meant to be a community of love. Paul wrote to this community of Christ followers that he had heard of their love and that it warmed his heart and lifted his spirit. Their activity with and toward one another was defined by a deep commitment to agape, which is a Greek word which means self-giving love. And this was no sentimental love in name only. The agape which held this community together was not just a feeling or an abstract concept, but rather a tangible, intimate, loving concern. They call each other fellow laborers. The individualistic character of faith for many Christians today does not exactly resemble this picture of the early Christian way of life. The center of their faith is not an abstract feeling of affection for God or each other, as some might feel in personal religious experiences. Rather, their faith was shared. Faith apparently was something they had in common, holding it in common, and not something merely inside themselves individually. They were building a community of love, and they recruited people from different castes for the same work. And their faith consisted in them holding each other together and working alongside each other, involving their whole being, mind and body. Demonstrating Christian love, Paul took it upon himself to advocate for a slave, even as he was imprisoned. In his appeal, he expresses deep affection for Onesimus, laying bare his desire to remain close to him and referring to Onesimus as my own heart. What's more, Paul professes love toward every member of the community he mentions, including Sister Aphia, the second co-worker he names in his greeting after Philemon. Paul appeals to Philemon on the basis of love, after expressing his delight with hearing reports of the strength of this community's love, which seems also to have made equals of men and women. But this community of love did not live in a world defined by love. The world first century Christians lived in was a world of hierarchy and exploitation, a slave economy. But we should keep in mind that first century slavery was different from the slavery of settler colonialism. Yes, first century slavery did consist of people lacking rights and self-determination and being subject to overlords who more or less ruled their lives. At the same time, first century slavery was not based on racism, and the status of slave was much more fluid in their context. Most slaves could expect to be emancipated at some point in their lives, either when they reached a certain age or when they were able to save enough money to buy their freedom. Many people also sold themselves into slavery for a certain sum of money, with which they could then purchase property or invest in some endeavor. This arrangement would then allow them to save money and later buy themselves out of slavery if they chose. So the rank of slave was not the lowest in the Roman hierarchy. The Romans sought to make their slave system function well by providing slaves housing and food, and granting them the privileges of owning property, making contracts, and in some cases, sharing in profits and receiving wages. So, consequently, worse than being a slave was being a poor day laborer who had to look for work each day without knowing whether they'd find some, who had to frequently face desperation, and who had no home. Within this context, the fact that Paul is making an appeal to a head of household on behalf of a slave says a lot about this community. Christ's followers were on the margins of society. Not only could they be prisoners and slaves, but they could also be found in the business of emancipating slaves, subverting the social hierarchy and patriarchal structure of the Greco-Roman household. Although I don't know if even like the word emancipating is the right word there, because in this context, Onesimus would remain in the household, but his just the fact of his relationship would, the character of the relationship would change. Paul, who in Philemon's household would not have been a slave, but rather a friend and honored guest, says to Philemon, "Treat your slave the way you treat me. Welcome him as you would welcome me." And he confessed this slave as my own heart. With these words, Paul de-particularized himself and tied himself to the person of Onesimus. He wanted Philemon not to separate or compartmentalize the two of them, but instead to regard Paul and Onesimus as one and to act accordingly. "If Onesimus owes you anything," he wrote, "put it on me. Make me your debtor." Paul thus took total responsibility for satisfying the claim Philemon had on Onesimus' life. I do have a question for Paul, though. Why did he not explicitly deny the institution of slavery? Someone doesn't want me to ask this question. Why did he not lay down a clear denunciation of the practice of enslaving another person? This is a difficult question. One we're not going to be able to resolve tonight together. But in addressing it, I want to clarify more about the historical context. Under Rome's formidable and unprecedented occupation of vast expanses of land and civilizations, the crisis for many occupied peoples in the first century was precisely this shocking totality of Rome's stronghold. The historian Josephus made this predicament clear in his telling of a conversation between King Herod of Judea and leaders of a Jewish revolt. The king criticizes the rebels in no uncertain terms, calling the Romans masters of the whole world, and exhorting the rebels to open your eyes to the power of the Roman Empire and measure it against your own impotence. He then walked the rebels through a history of Rome's many conquests and the many peoples who fought tirelessly and failed to preserve their independence. So the king concludes, in the inhabited world, all are Romans. So the totality of Rome's power occasioned in many people, especially in the worshippers of Yahweh, an existential crisis. If all rebel movements are just going to be crushed by Roman armies, what hope of abundant life and beloved community is there? In these conditions, abolishing slavery was not on the table. It would have been virtually unimaginable. Paul could tell particular people how they should act toward one another, but he couldn't imagine dismantling the entire superstructure of domination that determined the Roman occupied world. Apparently. Sadly, Paul and other early Christians didn't know what this fact would cost 14 centuries later, when a man who was deemed vicar of Christ wrote an official bull granting kings and princes approval to travel across the world, conquer other peoples, and subject them to perpetual slavery. Those were his words. Thus paving the way for the transatlantic slave trade in which European colonials displaced and enslaved millions of people for hundreds of years. Consequently, today we face a similar imperial totality with the global capitalism of the American Empire. Our own status quo was built on a racist slave economy, which, counterintuitively, Christianity made possible. Global capitalism, too, seems to eclipse any hope of radical social change. Yet we do have a decisive difference. Rome made no claim to democracy or ideals of human freedom. Theirs was a culture proudly based on conquest and domination. Whereas the American Empire is, at least in name, a democratic republic, which boasts of its founding ideals of liberty and justice for all. We in the American context thus have grounds for pursuing these ideals. And we have a certain means, however humble, of influencing the outcome of our political economic context. Our modest opening for change may afford us more optimism regarding political action, so that we don't have to follow the early Christians' resignation toward the fundamental structure of Roman imperial life. At the same time, however, the early Christians do provide us a profound example of what to do when all hope seems to be lost. You may not be able to change the structures of the society you inhabit, but you may always have community. There is always the love you exhibit toward other people, and the love you can meet in return. So what do you do when your society consists of households defined by patriarchal hierarchies? You transform life within those households so that the differences of rank and status become meaningless. as Paul wrote in another letter to the Galatians. And here we're climbing out of only knowing Philemon. We now know he wrote another letter to the Galatians. In Christ there is neither Jew nor Gentile, male nor female, slave nor free, for all are one. In his letter to Philemon, Paul makes clear that this principle was not a mere abstract ideal, but was in fact an actual practice among early Christians, and a standard for them to hold people to. It meant that they took responsibility for each other across differences in caste, subverting the established orders, regarding each other equally as children of the Most High God, who binds them together in love. So Paul exhorted Philemon, "You consider yourself the master of Onesimus, but in this you forget who your own master is. Jesus Christ is the master who abolishes masterdom, the Lord against all lords, precisely because Jesus' masterdom is no masterdom at all. While the great tent of Jesus covers all, and the way of Jesus applies to everyone, yet the goodness of Christ's way of life does not dominate, but rather liberates everyone. It liberates the slave out from under his master, and liberates the master from his place as an oppressor." Paul says to Philemon, "I could have just kept Onesimus and stolen him out from under you. But I would rather appeal to you on the basis of Christian love, making it clear to you what it really means to be a Christian. It means relinquishing your lawful claim to dominate other human beings and instead making yourself their comrade." Paul thus subverts not only the Roman household, but also the logic of imprisonment to which he himself was subject. Rather than coercively take a human being and cast them away as punishment, Paul sought transformative justice and reconciliation. Let the masters freely give up their masterdom. Let them embrace their slaves as beloved siblings and not as their slaves. Let us have beloved community and not a system of separation and domination. We may not be able to change the broader socioeconomic circumstances, but we can refuse to follow its rules in our own lives. We can abolish oppression for ourselves and live in loving community with one another. As James Baldwin wrote, "Not everything is lost. Responsibility is not lost." So after a brief period of silence, we will open up the floor to other people because we share the sermon. So if you have a story or experience that came up for you either during the scripture reading or the sermon, you're invited to share that. But we will begin in silence.